is the one we read a moment ago, Mark chapter 9, verses 2 to 13. You can imagine, can't you, Jesus walking up to a group of his disciples and saying to them, I want to speak to you, and I want to speak to you, referring to James and John. Oh, and I want to speak to you as well, Peter. And Peter takes a deep breath. It's been nearly a week since Jesus rebuked him with strong words, but the wound is still sore. And he wonders what Jesus wants to ask him this time. And Jesus takes them aside and he says, we're going up there. It's a mountain. It's quite a big mountain. And they scratch their heads. Why are we going up a mountain? What on earth does that mean? Mark's gospel has taken us through deserts. It's taken us across stormy seas. And actually, we've been up a mountain or two as well, haven't we? The apostles were appointed on a mountain back in chapter 3. Jesus prayed on a mountain in chapter 6. Mountains have some kind of significance to Jesus, these disciples will be thinking. Things happen on mountains, but what is it this time? And so these three men, they follow Jesus apprehensively, a bit like Isaac following Abraham up that mountain, wondering what's going to happen at the top. And it's from that perspective, the disciples' perspective, that I want us to consider this passage this evening. What is it that these disciples learn once they're down from the other side of the mountain in verse 13? What do the disciples learn in this passage, and what do we then learn with them? Well, I just want to draw your attention to two things in this passage that we learn, two things that this passage teaches us about the glory of Jesus Christ. Two things that this passage teaches us about the glory of Jesus Christ. Firstly, it teaches us about a visible but impermanent glory. A visible but impermanent glory. Now, do tell me if my sermons are getting too imaginative, but I want you to again imagine another scenario. We're with Moses this time, and Moses is looking at his watch, and he's thinking to himself, it's almost time. And he's remembering those strange days he spent on the Sinai Peninsula. He's remembering that difficult trudge, huffing and puffing up the side of Mount Sinai, wondering what exactly was going to happen when he reached the top of that mountain. And in particular, as he's remembering those days back in the wilderness, he's remembering a day in Exodus chapter 33, a day that we considered, Dan considered a few weeks ago in one of his sermons, a day when Moses says to the Lord, please show me your glory. See, Moses had wanted, for his reassurance, a visible display of the glory of God. He wanted to see with his physical eyes the essential immensity of God. And the Lord heard that prayer. And the Lord answered that prayer, but not without serious qualification. He promises to briefly pass by Moses. But, he says, you shall not see my face, for man shall not see me and live. You see, for Moses to look upon God visibly would have seen him dead. So what Moses ends up seeing, as Dan said a few weeks ago, is a brief flyby of God, but God turned on his back, seen only through the cracks in God's fingers and from within the cleft of a rock. And even then, that experience is enough to make Moses' face glow to the extent that it was actually disturbing for the other Israelites, and they wanted him to put a veil over that face. But today is going to be different for Moses. Today is a day which has been in the calendar for a very long time, and the watch is now ticking. And now Moses gets this new command. Now is the time, Moses, that prayer of yours all those years ago, now is the time to see the face, the visible face of God. And before he knows it then, Moses has arrived on another mountain. And the whole thing comes flooding back to him. Those great mountain views looking out and the scenery all around it, that cold mountain air which he can smell, it's so fresh. And then that sense of awe as he stands up there and even terror. And now that great black cloud comes sweeping around the top of that mountain and that glowing skin of those around him. And then finally that thunderous voice of God booming out of the cloud. And what's that voice saying? Well, essentially that voice is saying to Moses, this is it. This is my glory, my visible glory. See him with your naked eyes and speak to him face to face. But you see, Moses hasn't ascended the mountain this time. He's descended down to it. Moses is the one who's come down from heaven. No, it's the glory itself which has trudged, huffing and puffing, up that mountain with his three friends. Except now that he's on the top, he is glowing, he is basking in the Father's pleasure, he is transfigured. The curtain has been pulled back on his identity a little bit, and the immensity of God in Jesus Christ is being seen visibly. This is my beloved Son, says God in chapter 9 and verse 8. This is my Son sharing in the very substance of God, yet made man. This is a visible display of the glory of God. And it's an extremely powerful moment for everyone who's involved. This isn't just another event in the ministry of Jesus Christ. Perhaps that's how we're tempted to think about it. We read through the Gospels, and this is just another thing which happens along with all the other miracles that Jesus performs. But no, that's not what it is. This is heaven's own celebration of the Son of God made visible on earth. This is a serious event in heaven's calendar. And it's not as if Moses and Elijah are just kind of film props or extras who are brought in last minute to another episode of the life of Jesus Christ. Moses, do you mind just standing there for a second so we can just get you in shot for a few moments? It'll only be a second, then we can let you go. No, this is a greatly anticipated exhibition of the glory of God made visible in the Son of God, and Moses and Elijah are privileged guests participating in that. And more than privileged guests, I think actually Moses and Elijah contribute to this glory of God. They contribute to this transfiguration of Jesus Christ. I mean, think about how it must have been for these disciples to see Jesus in their company. Perhaps you've had this kind of experience yourselves. Perhaps you've been at some conference or some event, some special dinner maybe, and you find yourself chatting to another guest. And you're chatting happily about family and about your hobbies and about your job. But then as you're chatting to this guest, you notice a few people loitering around behind them. And then you recognize one of them. It's the famous journalist from the newspaper, or maybe one of them is someone you've seen on the TV, or someone who you're pretty sure it's a well-known MP. And then they come over to this guest, and maybe one of them whispers in this guest's ear. Maybe one of them breaks into the conversation and says, oh, hello, I just wanted to say how much I appreciated. And another one says, long time, no see. And then it dawns on you in that instance, you're not just chatting to another guest. You're chatting to perhaps the event organizer themselves, or you're chatting to the lead speaker at this conference you're at, or you're chatting to a member of the band of the concert that you're at. And instantly then, in that moment, everything changes underneath your feet. It's almost as if that person transfigures in your eyes. At least in the sense of your estimations of that person, they transform. And that then is something surely of the experience of these disciples in this moment. Moses? Elijah? Sorry, what are they doing here? And suddenly then the immensity, the glory of Jesus Christ dawns on them in that moment. Except that Jesus also literally transfigures, doesn't he? And it's not just Moses and Elijah who speak warmly of him. It's the Father himself booming his approval, speaking to this guest out of heaven. So in the light of all that, then, it's not surprising that these disciples are a little bit lost for words in all of this. It's not surprising that Peter doesn't really know what to say. I think actually you get the sense in which these disciples are lost for words, even in recollecting the event later on in their lives. You can imagine Mark writing his gospel, can't you, and turning to Peter as his chief source and saying to Peter, "So, just explain it to me again. Just how white were Jesus' clothes, just so I know what to put here in this gospel?" And Peter says, "Well, they're whiter than anything I've ever seen produced by any launderer on the face of the earth." It's as if today Peter would be saying, "They're brighter even than Vanish Oxy Action." And you get the impression that's a bit of an understatement, don't you, given that Jesus' clothes were actually glowing. No, this is a big moment. This is the moment where God gets to glorify his incarnate Son. The Father opens the curtains for a moment, and something of the immensity of what it means to be the Son of God comes shining through those windows. Peter will say later on that they were eyewitnesses of Jesus' majesty in that moment. Jesus received honor and glory from the Father, is what he says. This is the glory of God made visible. And the first thing I just want to say this evening as we consider that is that if you have tended to think of this moment simply as another event in the life of Jesus, reconsider it. No, this is a powerfully visible glorification. The glory of the Son of God unveiled by the Father in heaven. This is spectacular stuff. And for these disciples, it should have blasted away any concerns about whose side God and heaven were as far as their Saviour, the Lord Jesus Christ, was concerned. But although it's a visible glory that we are witnessing here, it's impermanent. Because before we dig into any of the significance of the Transfiguration on any other level, I just want us to see that this spectacular visibility shining out of Jesus Christ does eventually disappear in this moment. It's visible, but it's impermanent. Peter is lost for words. It says that he does not know what to say in verse 6, but what he does say is telling, isn't it? Verse 5, he says, "Rabbi, it is good that we're here. Let us make three tents, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah." It's a bit like that thing that children do when they're at their friend's house and the man comes round to pick them up and they want to say, "Just another 5 minutes." And then they think to themselves, "If only we can keep the parents chatting, maybe at some point we can slip in the suggestion of having a sleepover." Well, Peter here cuts straight to the sleepover demand. "Let's get some tents up. Let's make this a thing. Let's go camping. Let's have a sleepover." And here's why I bring this up then. I bring this up because my guess is that Peter here is really expressing a kind of anxiety about this whole thing. He's trying to prolong the impermanence. He's trying to defer an inevitable future by prolonging the present. He's trying to make something permanent which is impermanent. Remember, Peter has had a tough week. Peter has had, for the last week, the words of Jesus ringing in his ears. Jesus saying to Peter, "The Son of Man must be killed," in chapter 8, verse 31. And Peter's thinking to himself this week, "Must be killed? Must be killed? This is Jesus we're talking about. He must be killed." And that thought appalled him a week ago, such that he was prepared to rebuke his teacher Jesus. And we can't just assume that he's gotten over that thought now. No, even part of him perhaps has accepted the words of Jesus that he has to die. But even still, there is a deep part of him that has to defer that outcome. He doesn't want that to happen. The future looks dark for both Jesus and for him. And so he is desperate to prolong the present. And so what then is his instinctive response upon reaching this heavenly summit, this place of peace and safety? His response is, "Rabbi, this is good. This is good. I don't want to leave, Rabbi. Rabbi, let's camp for a bit. Let's put up some tents. Let's prolong this experience as much as we can. To which Peter receives a terrifying, thunderous response, booming out of the heavens in verse 7, booming out of that cloud. This is my beloved son, Peter, not just a rabbi, and you need to listen to him. And what does this beloved son say? What does Peter need to listen to? Well, we conclude this passage in verse 12 with Jesus telling Peter and James and John that the Son of Man should suffer many things and be treated with contempt. That's what Peter needs to understand. He needs to understand that this glory, though it is good, it's very good, it is impermanent, sadly impermanent. And however difficult that might have felt for Peter to have to stomach that, it was a truth that he had to stomach. Dark times were coming. It's not wrong for Peter to enjoy this glory-filled experience and want it to carry on. Like I said, it's good. He's right when he says it's good. It's terrifying, but it's terrifyingly good. But the risk is that Peter is becoming so averse to loss and to sacrifice, he would rather put on pause God's plan and settle for a very limited taste of heaven rather than go about things God's way, take up his cross, and enjoy greater joys later on. Peter's like a man on his holiday to the seaside. He knows that the last 5 minutes of the journey, he'll have to pass through a forest where he won't be able to see the sea anymore. And because he can't bear to lose sight of the sea, he pulls up in a lay-by on the way before the forest where he can see the sea from a distance and tries to have his holiday in that lay-by instead. He's pausing the present to avoid the future. Of course, our situation this evening is very different to Peter's. It's not easy to apply this point. But isn't there also a risk in our lives that we want to put up tents, we want to pause things too early because we worry about what lies ahead? Perhaps you're in a position in life right now which is very comfortable. You could just happily go on like this forever. Well, let me remind you that you have higher duties in this life as a Christian than to be comfortable. At times you might be tempted to pray something like, well, this is about right now, Lord. This is good. I really like life as it is now. I'm quite happy just not dying at all, actually, and just keeping things this way, like this forever. And there's nothing wrong with desiring peace and security. There's nothing wrong with enjoying the good things in life, but only insofar as we submit our chief duties to what God tells us to do. We submit ultimately to his plan, and we don't kick up a fuss when things have to change. Rather, we should pray something like this. We should pray, give me grace, Lord, to follow you to the end and look forward to the ultimate destination. Thank you that things are good now. I'm enjoying this peace and security while it lasts, but do not allow me to cling to it too firmly. Rather, give me the grace to follow you, whatever life might bring. We should embrace the impermanent glory in this life, but recognize that it is impermanent. So these disciples then, they behold a visible but impermanent glory. Sorry, a visible but impermanent glory. But secondly, I want us to see here an invisible but permanent glory. An invisible but permanent glory. In verse 11, the disciples ask Jesus, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And in verse 12, Jesus replies to that by saying that Elijah does come first to restore all things. What does that question tell us about what's in the disciples' heads at this moment? Well, I think it tells us that at this stage, the disciples are still holding out hopes for a more optimistic future. See, most likely what they're thinking about is Malachi chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4, where it tells us that just before the great day of the Lord, Elijah will return, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers. He'll bring about some social harmony across the earth. And the scribes had read those verses and they'd encouraged optimistic visions of that social harmony brought about by Elijah's return. When Elijah returned, things were going to get good, they were teaching. And perhaps these disciples are thinking now to themselves, well, we've just seen Elijah up there on that mountain. Doesn't that mean he has come now? I mean, doesn't that perhaps mean that things are actually going to get better now, Jesus, not worse? Maybe this suffering thing isn't quite as bad as you're expecting, Jesus? Maybe you've made a little bit of a mistake in understanding what your role is. I mean, that was definitely Elijah. We saw him with our very eyes. And you know what the scribes say? It's good news when Elijah arrives. Maybe you don't have to suffer and die after all, Jesus? And so when Jesus answers this question in verse 13, he has to deal with this false optimism which the disciples are harboring. And this is how he does it. Firstly, he tells them that a second Elijah has come already, and they did to him what they pleased. In other words, they abused him, they rejected him. And if you're wondering who I'm referring to, who that second Elijah is he is referring to, well then notice, secondly, Jesus tells them that this mistreatment of a second Elijah was foretold in the scriptures. He finishes the verse by saying, as it is written of him. Now how does that help us to see who this second Elijah might be? Well, I think when Jesus is saying, as it is written, Jesus is referring to the mistreatment of the first Elijah, of what Elijah himself faced during his own ministry, back in 1 Kings chapter 17 to 21. Elijah's righteous stand against King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, and the constant persecution which Elijah faced because of that, and the way in which Elijah then was driven for a time into a frugal lifestyle in the wilderness. The kind of mistreatment which was also faced by who? By John the Baptist, and John's stand against Herod and Herodias, and the persecution that John faced at their hands, and the wilderness lifestyle which John went into. People had already made that connection between John and Elijah, and here I think Jesus is making it again. John the Baptist was the second Elijah who was to come, and you know what? They treated him even worse than the first, Jesus is saying. He went from the blistering wilderness to the dingy prison cell, to the blood-filled dinner plate. They did to him whatever they pleased. That's how Jesus bursts their false optimism. Now, I appreciate there's a lot we could say about this point, and we're already trying to keep lots of things together in our heads at the moment. And if we were in another gospel where the connections between John and Elijah are spelt out a bit more clearly, then this might be a little bit simpler. But for now, I just want us to see this, that at the end of this passage, Jesus is making these disciples hold together a couple of ideas which, at first sight, are very confusing, which can't be held together. On the one hand, Jesus is saying that both Elijahs suffered horribly. He's telling them that suffering is part of the Elijah job description. He's saying you don't want to be an Elijah. That's nasty stuff. Don't get too optimistic about Elijah. But on the other hand, he is agreeing with the scribes that Elijah is this worthy figure who does have a worthy role in restoring all things. That is also part of his job description. And more than that, these disciples have just met this chap, Elijah, and guess what? He looked pretty good. Elijah looked pretty awesome on that mountain, basking in the glory of Jesus. So once again then, these disciples are being challenged in their preconceptions. They're being challenged to hold together this suffering on the one hand and this glory on the other. Jesus is saying glory and suffering, they aren't opposed like you might think. Sometimes, perhaps even normally, ordinarily, these things go together. And it's in that context, then, that Jesus now asks them this question in the middle of that passage in verse 12. And it is a question. It's a rhetorical question. He says to them in that verse, "And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt?" See, Jesus is getting these disciples to see that this same mystery, glory and suffering, go together in his own vocation, in his own job description. How can this be? He's asking them. He's saying, if you're struggling to square Elijah, the Elijah of Malachi chapter 4, with the Elijah of 1 Kings 17 and John the Baptist, now try squaring the Son of Man in his glory in Daniel chapter 7 and the Son of Man you've just seen on this mountain in his glory with the suffering servant of Isaiah 53 and the absolute necessity for him to go and die for his people. He is getting them to see that glory and suffering go together. It might be a mystery, but there they are together in harmony. And the point I'm really trying to come to is this. The mountain of transfiguration teaches these disciples and teaches us with them that whatever might lie ahead on Jesus' path, and he's telling them very clearly that the Son of Man has to die, he has to be treated with contempt, but whatever might happen on that path, whatever level of humiliation he faces, whatever depths of death he sinks to, that nevertheless, that will never undermine the fact of the permanent glory of Jesus Christ and the love of the Father for the Son that was displayed on that mountain. Those two things, the suffering and the glory, will exist in harmony together. Even when that glory of the Son of God seems completely invisible, it will be there permanently. I'll put it like this. The visible, impermanent display of glory on the mountain is there to teach the disciples about the permanent, if sometimes invisible, glory that lies ahead on the road. He's saying the visible, impermanent display of glory on the mountain is there to teach the disciples about the permanent, if sometimes invisible, glory which the Son of God has at all times. The Father will always love the Son, no matter what. That's what's being said on that mountain. The Son will always be glorious in and of himself, even from within the veil of suffering. That's what we're being told on that mountain. Those permanent facts are established on that mountain, and they will never die. And so we read Jesus telling these disciples in verse 9. "And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead." Now, that sounds like a bad thing. That sounds like they've got this hard charge. They're bound to this burden of secrecy. They can't speak about it. They have to share with Jesus the difficulty of holding these things back from others. But there is a blessing in those words as well, isn't there? Because it's as if he's saying to the disciples in that verse, "You will see me in glory again. I will break the power of death. I will rise to a new glorious life. But before we get there, I will have to die, and you will have to pass through the darkness of that. But until that day, you need to treat this experience, this transfiguration that you've seen, like a personal little candle. It's this candle that I'm giving to you personally. You're not to share it with others. It's just for you. This memory of this day is to be your little candle that you keep all to yourselves as you pass through the darkest moment of your life. And as it gets darker and darker, you need to remember what you saw. You saw the never-ending love of a father for a son. And you saw the promise of light and goodness and fellowship. And you saw the inextinguishable glory of Jesus Christ as it really is behind the veil. A permanent, if sometimes invisible, glory. That will get you through until you reach the other side. And then you may speak of what you've seen as openly as you like. See, as we make our way through this book week by week, whether we like it by not, we are hurtling towards another mountain, a dark, painful, ugly mountain, a mountain of the skull. And you see, if we fail to hold onto the mountain of transfiguration that we've just been on, if we fail to hold onto the memory of that, then this coming mountain will never be more than just a monstrosity. It will just be a place of hopeless bleeding and dying and screaming. It'll be a place where we see a man who's not clothed in radiant lights, but a man who is shrouded in darkness, a man who's had his clothes stripped from him and divided up among gamblers, a man who won't be flanked on either side by prophets, but by two criminals, and the conversation there won't be sweet. It will be painful, it will be breathless, it will be abusive. There'll be no booming voice of a father coming out of heaven approving of his son. There'll only be this confused child who feels like an orphan, weeping and asking this distant God why he's been forsaken, and a heaven then which answers with stony silence. And he'll cry up in that cry of dereliction, and some people will think he's crying out for Elijah, and they'll wait and they'll think, is Elijah going to come? But Elijah doesn't come to this mountain. And then he will die, and his eyes will glaze over. And then he will be put in the tomb, and they'll roll a stone across that tomb, and even from within the darkness of that tomb, his body will stiffen and change colour and begin to rot, just like every other pretend Messiah which had gone before him. You see, without the glory that we see at the Mount of Transfiguration, that second mountain, the mountain of crucifixion, is very bleak indeed. But when we hold together the truth of the transfiguration and everything we learn about in Mark chapter 9 with the crucifixion, then we find that everything changes. When we view the cross through the prism of Mark chapter 9, then we realize that at no point in that whole horrible affair did the Son lose one ounce of his native glory. And at no point in all heaven's silence did the Father lose one ounce of approval and love for his Son. And he still stands resolutely by every single word he spoke on that mountain. And if that is true, then the cross becomes a place where we see what everyone else fails to see. We see history's most glorious and most profound display of a son's obedient love for a father and a father's proud love for a son and a God's sacrificial love for the whole world. Indeed, we might say that viewed in the transfiguration light, the cross itself, in a sense, transfigures. And even in the darkest elements of that occasion, we find this powerful inner light radiating. I mean that in some mysterious sense, that crown of shameful thorns on his head becomes its own radiant crown of glory. And that cheap purple robe which they wrap around him becomes in its own way radiant as this royal gown of glory. And that horrible blood-covered cross becomes its own throne of glory. Because we believe in Mark chapter 9, we can look at that cross with the same level of transfiguration awe and transfiguration terror, and we can say with the centurion, surely this man was the Son of God. It might be an invisible glory, in a sense. It's a veiled glory. But from the mount of his transfiguration to the depths of his death, Christ possesses this permanent glory. It's a glory which can't help eventually to smash up through that grave and break up into new radiant resurrection life. And it's for us then as God's people to stand back and to gaze upon the brilliant radiant ministry of Jesus Christ from start to finish. His is the glory even when his is the shame. Look at it, be in awe at it, take it all in. And I want to bring this to a close this evening by saying this, that when we do gaze upon the glory of Jesus Christ, seen explicitly in that transfiguration, but by implication then existing throughout his whole ministry, when we do gaze upon that glory, something happens to us. The term transfiguration in the Bible is a broad term. It just simply means transformation. But at the same time, it's a rare word in the Bible. It appears only four times. Once in Mark, once in Matthew, with the actual transfiguration accounts. But the third time it's used is in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. The familiar verse, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed," that is, be transfigured, "by the renewal of your mind." Here we're dealing not with physical transfiguration, but with moral and mental transfiguration. And we're not talking about Jesus anymore, we're talking about the transfiguration of his people. And the fourth use of that word teaches us how that moral and mental transfiguration comes about. It's a verse that we've again referred to recently in Dan's sermons, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18. The Apostle Paul, in that passage, has been speaking about the radiance of Moses at Sinai. And then he says at the end of that passage, in verse 18, "And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed," that is, being transfigured, "from one degree of glory into another." The point is this, that when we as believers gaze upon Christ with unveiled faces, when we gaze upon the radiant glory of Jesus Christ, we change mentally and morally. And even more profoundly than that, we participate somehow in a glorification ourselves. We share in the glory of God. We transfigure. And we transfigure just as radically. It's a radical word which is reserved for that occasion. As radical as the transfiguration of Jesus on the Mount, we might say the moral and mental transfiguration which takes place in us when we gaze on the glory of God takes place. You know, the visible display of Jesus Christ's glory on this mountain, it clearly impacted Peter and John. You can see it in their writings. Peter will write about that account, and he will say that we were eyewitnesses of his majesty, for when he received honor and glory from God the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased," we ourselves heard this very voice born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain. He remembers it. He wants to write about it. It's actually not all that relevant to his overall argument in the book, but he wants to mention it. John will mention it. John will say, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." Surely John has Mark chapter 9 in mind as he writes those words. This event wasn't forgotten by these people. They gazed upon that physical glory of Jesus Christ, and it changed them forever. But you know, it wasn't just that transfiguration, that transfiguration into visible glory, which impacted them. No, rather, they witnessed themselves the permanent glory of the life of Jesus Christ, his moral life, his moral beauty. And I would put it to you that as they gazed upon that glory, it impacted them in a far more profound way than they could have imagined. By gazing upon Jesus' whole glorious life, Peter and John and James were transfigured mentally and morally and spiritually. And that should be an immense encouragement for us, shouldn't it? Do you ever worry that you are a selfish, stubborn, boisterous creature with a mind which so easily conforms to this world and is hooked by worldly riches? Well, you're right about that. But don't you remember that John was also a boisterous son of thunder, and that he once asked Jesus for a physical king's throne? How is it then that that same man, John, could write these words, which are so brimming with sacrifice and love? "By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers." I mean, you read that and you think, is that the same person? It is. How do you explain that change? Well, he gazed upon the glory of the sacrificial, loving Son of God. Perhaps you think you're an impulsive, self-assured little creature who's first to speak and then finds actually he's a bit of a coward later. Well, maybe you are, but have you met this chap called Peter? Do I even need to tell you about Peter? That Peter. How is it then that that Peter, that Christ-denying Peter, could eventually go on to write these words? For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were straying like sheep, but have now returned the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Who do you think Peter has in mind when he says straying like sheep? He remembers what he was like. What changed? Well, he gazed on the glory of Jesus Christ, and he was changed by it. He was transfigured morally and mentally. And if there's hope for James and John and Peter, those sinful, arrogant, world-centered people that they were, then there is hope for us. Let's look upon the glory of Jesus Christ throughout all of his life, from this beautiful Mount of Transfiguration to the depths of his death, as an act of love and sacrifice for us. And let's look upon all of that and let's be transformed inwardly. Let's be transfigured into the glory of Jesus Christ. Amen. Let us close now.